Okay.
Hello.
Good morning. Thank you for joining us for another episode of Silicon Beach Mobile Startup. I'm your host, Baron Murdoch. Today, I'm joined by the founders of Alpha, Renata Thome, and Manuela Save. Manuela and Renata, welcome.
Thank you
so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, yeah, great. Thank you for having us.
No, I think this is it's a great opportunity. I like what your company is doing. I like the space that you're in. And I want you guys to start off by giving us an idea of how did you come up with the name Alpha?
Mm-hmm. Sure. So I think, you know, to talk about the name, we have to talk a little bit about my background. I'm a finance background, and most of my career before Alpha was spent in fundamental analysis for equities. And the term to generate alpha is basically to have a superior return along the same risk line. So, you know, basically an outlier. And that's exactly what we wanted to do in the visual art market.
Okay, that makes sense. And then from there, moving into the ideation or the creating of the idea, you guys came together because you had like minds in the space, I assume.
Exactly. Yeah.
Who was the creative partner in this interaction?
So Renata, maybe tell a little bit about your story because you're chief creative officer. So obviously the creative part.
No, you can start maybe telling about Manuela started a company back in 2014 and we met on the launch of the MVP of Alpha. But I think like one thing which is important to say also is that like Alpha became so many different companies within the same company that it's hard to say. But definitely my background is in the traditional art market. I studied art history work for a little while at Christie's Auction House, David Zorner Gallery. And that point in time, I started being very critical about the way that they did their own businesses and started thinking about technology and how technology could improve this business model. And that's what brought Manuela and I together, I think.
Yeah. And I, on the other hand, even though I'm a finance background, I grew up surrounded by art. My dad's an art dealer. My mother's an artist. So we were both knowledgeable about the market, but as Renata mentioned, critical about the business model.
So Manuela, if you would please tell me exactly what does Alpha do? What is your platform?
Absolutely. So Alpha is a B2B marketplace and we connect companies to the visual arts. So essentially what we do is we license artwork by thousands of artists all around the world and we drop ship limited edition prints, which are produced always in the continent where our client is based. What does that mean? That means that we can actually import and export art without the hassle of logistics, since everything is printed, framed, etc., at the same country where our end client is going to be.
Okay, that makes sense. So in terms of the stakeholders that would have an interest in Alpha, the two that come to mind would be, first of all, the artist. That's your primaries. That's your primary, I would assume, right?
Yeah, that's the provider.
Yeah.
Okay. Meaning the whole goal is you're trying to create a very large community of talented artists that are a part of your platform.
Mm-hmm.
And that large community of talented artists would be a reason for corporate clients like Hyatt, Hilton, any boutique hotel or corporate client. Right.
Absolutely. And, you know, shared living space, companies like Airbnb, Zeus Living, amongst others, which anyone in the real estate sector that has a lot of walls to fill. What we find is art is usually the last thing to come in. You know, there's usually very little budget left, but you can't really deliver a project without artwork hanging on the walls.
OK, that makes sense. So, Renata, how would you say what's one of the best strengths you think Manuela brings to the table within this partnership?
Oh my God, so many. but I think I've learned a lot with Manuela and she really is a go-getter. I think she's the definition of a go-getter. Like she's unstoppable. And I think she's also an optimistic, which is very important when you're running her business or in life in general. So she's always like expecting like the best out of people, out of projects, out of everything. And gradually, like, we started seeing that coming true. So it's quite inspiring to be around.
Now, Manuela and
I can picture tears.
That's great. Now, Manuela and Renata, I always look at, when you look at a software program, I look at the front end and the back end. So would you say that, Manuela, you are more of, you are the user interface with most of the clientele, and would Renata be more of the interface with the artists on the back end and the team that's developing the flow?
So is that's that the separation of powers? 100% correct.
Yeah, that's quite accurate.
Yeah. That's quite accurate. I do deal with a lot of our clients, a lot of our investors, and, you know, I'm more on the business and strategic development side. And, you know, Renata is the creative soul. She really thinks different about things. And she's always concerned about how the artist would feel about everything. So Renata's the best person to talk about that, about what you're thinking about the product as well.
Yeah, no.
I'm glad you said that, because I feel like one of the biggest questions or the issues as technology evolves, a lot of people lose sight of the importance of customer service. So how would you guys best, each of you, describe how customer service is relevant to your business?
Yeah, I was just going to add about the user experience that at Alpha we try to be as human-centric as possible and try to develop solutions for of the problems we're trying to solve by focusing on the individuals, being them like the artists or the clients. And that's a concept that we took from user experience design. And so through like running interviews and really getting to know what are the pain points of those people, like, and trying to after that create a product that solves those problems. That's very important. So definitely customer service and being in contact with people and letting them know that even though we are an online platform, like we try to show our faces as much as possible so they understand that there is a very strong human side to the business.
Yeah. And now let me just add on that.
Oh, go ahead. Like, I'm sorry.
In the weekends and holidays when, you know, the rest of our team isn't working, I actually make it a point to answer our team email. So the email that we get from, you know, clients or artists, so that this way we're always in contact with whatever concerns they have or whatever is working, whatever isn't working, so that to avoid the lack of communication that sometimes happens when you have like an external group or an outsourced party doing customer service. Mm.
So let me ask you guys this question. What would you say are the top three pain points, or these three points would be the why for Alpha? What are the three points that you'd say this is why Alpha must exist?
Yeah. Manu, why don't you take the client side and I can take
the artist side.
Yeah.
Perfect. So yeah, so I think even like we have a new tagline, which is Alpha provides the provides the quality of a gallery, the speed of online, high customization, and accessible pricing. And those are exactly the problems that we're solving. Galleries are great, but they're extremely expensive and limited. Online is usually not very collectible. It's usually, you know, disposable posters, prints, etc., which don't really add to a project and can be detrimental to design concepts. And nothing is really customizable in this space. It's usually take it as you get it, which is a huge issue if you're working with a designer that has very specific specs for a project.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think on the creative side, the biggest problem is that a lot of artists don't even get to be a fully formed artist because they give up before they have that chance. And we know that this is a system that is not 100% meritocratic. There's a lot about like, who do you know, what our connections are. So what we try to do at Alpha, and that you can see like a lot, like in some of the tools we have, like the voting cycles, and we try to give everyone the same opportunity to show and to sell their art, having a sustainable revenue line, which is like from their own creative work. So they don't have to go after day jobs and work on their art, like on the sidelines, really making their creative practice the center of their daily activities.
Okay. I like the way you guys express that. And if I were to make a, you talked about the meritocracy, and with your platform, you're kind of democratizing yeah. the art world. And you're almost like, I would say, the iTunes of art.
Yeah.
Meaning any artist can make their way to your platform once they're vetted by you as a significant artist. And now this is a forum where you're going to be able to proliferate their IP all over the world, basically.
That's wow. amazing. Yeah.
I'm so happy
I was going
to
ask
that.
Manuela, did you tell him that?
No, I didn't. We're getting ready for demo day with one of our investors, MetaProp, which is, I think, the biggest prop tech fund in the United States. And they were asking us to come up with an analogy for Alpha. And we said exactly that. We're the iTunes mm-hmm. for the visual arts. We're a channel yeah. where, you know, artists can actually represent themselves and have immediate feedback and immediate sales revenue on their mediums.
So
no, that is
fantastic
awesome.
Description.
That is awesome. So we talked about the customer service piece. In terms of the business model, can you describe the business model and how it kind of plays out for the artist?
Sure. So how it works is an artist submits a high-res image of an artwork and he sends it over to us. We'll then license that artwork out and create an edition of his products, which are then available for purchase on the Alpha platform. And we'll handle everything from marketing to logistics to printing, framing, etc. And the artist actually keeps his original artwork, which sometimes is an oil painting or something of mm-hmm. the sorts, and we'll pay him a royalty on sales on every print sold, no matter where in the world.
Oh, that is unbelievable. That's awesome. So that is, I think, from the artist standpoint, that brings a lot of excitement. What are the countries that you're most excited to do business in?
We still source a lot of the art from Latin America. That's where we come from. Like, it's a big part of our DNA as a company. So we love bringing Latin art to the US and Europe, but like really like trying to work with the local communities and making those artworks available not only within the communities but like cross country. We are now expanding to Europe, so I guess that's exciting because it's a new geographical location, so new clients and also new creative communities for us to dive deep.
So is there a goal? I remember Manuela spoke about there was a show that you were involved with Bill and Tim Draper, possibly.
Yeah, absolutely.
Can you talk a little
so,
bit about
that? So this year, a few months ago, we filmed Meet the Drapers, which is the Draper family's version of kind of like their Shark Tank. But the sharks are so much nicer. We encourage every interpreter to apply and to watch it because they were amazing. The feedback that they gave us was amazing. And they
yes.
were so excited about us that, you know, we shouldn't probably give this away. It's a bit of a spoiler. But let's just say that we were involved in the next phase and we ended up filming another episode. And together with that show, we launched a pretty unique campaign, which actually just went live this week in order to allow our community and our stakeholders to be a mm-hmm. part of Alpha's success. So now they can invest in Alpha directly with tickets of as low as $100. So democratizing as well the access to venture capital.
Investing, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So this is kind of like, this is not a Kickstarter campaign, but this is an offering where there are micro investments, as you're saying, mm-hmm. as low as $100, where now they have some equity stake in the success of Alpha going forward. So this is pretty big.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. So it's kind of like a mini IPO, if you think of it. And we had to go through the same SEC regulations of any other share offering. So it really gave us the opportunity as well to organize our books like a big company would have to do. So it was positive in many fronts. And we're really excited to have all of these new investors on board. And a lot of them, we imagine, will actually be artists which are interested in proliferating this business model.
So tell me this, on this offering, is there a dollar goal, meaning is it $1 million is the maximum amount that you're the allotment for this particular offering for this segment?
Yeah, $1 million is the maximum allotment for this segment. We'll actually be launching in parallel an institutional round, which will be another $1 million. So the max raise right now would be $2 million. And on the institutional round, we're lucky enough that we have such great funds that are already our investors. So that's about 50% committed already.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's awesome. Now, have you had any opportunity to enlist a publicist and to begin a roadshow?
I know.
No, we haven't. This is completely...
No, where you can get national visibility?
No, this has been completely organic. And I think, you know, the show is global. So once it does air in January, we'll get a lot of bandwidth and, you know, we'll get a lot of new people involved in the company. But for now, it has been 100% word of mouth. And we've been kind of like in stealth mode since we literally just launched the campaign.
Okay, so you said it's been 100%.
Exactly.
Hello?
Eu tô aqui.
Acho que... Baron, can you hear us? Hello?
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 Shall we go to the next question?
I think he may be disconnected, no?
I believe so.
Hello?
Yeah, Manuela, can you hear me?
Hi.
Oh, yeah, you're back. Hello?
So the last thing you were saying, can you repeat that last statement?
We were talking about how we were democratizing access to, how the campaign has been completely organic so far and just word of mouth, but we expect a huge impact from the show that airs now in January 2020 and will be distributed worldwide, actually.
Oh, that's awesome. That's awesome. And you said January 20th is the air date for the particular show?
We don't have an exact air date for the show, but we know it's going to be in January of 2020, so in less than a month.
Okay. So are you partnering with FedEx, or which logistics company most often will be working with you to deal with the art?
So in the United States, we mostly work with UPS, and there have been good times and really bad times.
So I think there's going to be a good outcome with the company overall, but do you see a movement to individuals using your art within households? Mid-income as well as high-income?
Yeah, households? Absolutely. So even though we are a B2B company, we do see ourselves as B2B2C as well. So we place QR codes within some of our client spaces, including hospitality, which allows their audience to be able to walk by, scan, and even purchase a physical piece. So kind of like this art gallery experience mixed with technology. And also, we do have a consumer-facing website, which is up and running. Even though we don't really push it a lot, it has some amazing features, like creating your own collections, and our minimum order is one piece.
It's one piece. And we often say that art should be a right and not a privilege. So please go on our website, choose one of the beautiful things that we have. I'm sure it's going to make your life much better.
Yeah. Oh, that's awesome. So when you said about the QR code, which is for our audience, the QR code is a quick response code where you're going to scan it and then it'll link you to the website, link you back to the website to see either a video or the site to order.
Is that what the case is? It links directly to the platform and you can then see that piece, different sizes, different framing options, and purchase it directly from your phone.
And you can also go deeper into the profile of that artist, learn more about his career, see other pieces from the same artist. So you can have a little bit of context around that piece. So it's not simply a product, but you can understand where it's coming from, which we usually consider to be a very valuable thing when you're collecting.
Now, let me ask you this question. Now, I know there are companies that have the affiliate revenue model. Have you guys thought about that in terms of placing ads on different company sites to get another flow of traffic?
We really don't think of it as ads, but we do have white labels up on a number of different sites. So we have a white label for Guild. We have a white label for Zola. Zola is actually branded, so it's not even a white label. If you go into Zola and just search for Alpha, you'll find all our full collection of products that we built out for them and their customer base. Another platform that we're on is a company called Inviso, which does renovations for short-term rentals. Eporta, which is an interior designer platform, where we're rich in channel partnerships. Let's put it that way.
Okay, so that is the way you would phrase it. You have a lot of channel partnerships that already exist and you're creating.
Yeah,
more
we're creating more of those. It's a low lift initiative for us. We've developed APIs in-house that make this integration super easy and seamless. The first integration took us a month and now it only takes us a week max to get onto a new platform.
Okay. So that's huge. So from the time standpoint, that's very efficient.
Yeah, the idea is to be as efficient as possible.
So in terms of when we have this offering that is open now, the $1 million offering on the lower level, the lower tier pricing, and then you have the institutional offering, what is the timeline between the opening and the close of this offering?
So the idea is now we're kind of like in stealth mode in pre-launch. We had a great call today with a group of friends actually that have been tracking our progress since inception. So I think we're going to hit our funding minimum this week, which is very exciting. Then in January, we go kind of like full blast with the TV show and with, marketing. And we go on Republic's front page. They push out to their hundreds of thousands of users. And the idea is to have like this, the individual parts of the Republic campaign closed by March. The institutional round we know takes a little bit more time, and we're only opening that in January, and we expect that to be done by May.
Okay, that's great. So I'm really excited, first of all, for you guys and the value that the platform is bringing to the art community, but also from the standpoint of a consumer who likes art, the idea that I'm going to have a forum or an area that I can go to and see unique pieces of art that I haven't seen before. So in terms of how will you try to approach the European market, other parts of whether it's Asia or Africa, how will you try to involve those countries and grab artists from those areas?
Hey, do you want to take him through our curation models?
Sure. So initially, like we started, finding artists and selecting the artworks, which would then become limited edition prints by crowdsourcing. So we would create a selection of artworks, group them together, and then open to the public to decide what are their favorite pieces. After we moved the company to the US, we started creating partnerships with local curators, which is the biggest portion of our work nowadays. So we always invite people or those curators to create a selection of artists and artworks that represent them. And we offer together that collection on our website that would be hosted under special projects, And the third way that we do our curation, which is my personal favorite, and I think maybe Manuela's too, I don't know, it's by creating campaigns on social and environmental causes. So trying to select subjects which are make sense for us, not only as professionals, but individuals as well. So we've ran our first project on this line 2 years ago, and it was around ocean conservation. And the most recent project was about forest conservation. And when we do something like this, we invite artists from all over the world, and we usually work a lot with MFA programs and art residencies, so focusing on clusters. We invite those artists to create artworks which can help us visually representing issues around those themes. So,
yeah, and I think the idea for the expansion geographically is one, more of the same, so kind of like a land, expand, retain strategy, and two, to continue our high level focus on clusters. So thinking of opinion formers in London, meeting with curators in Madrid to understand kind of like how the local scenery is in terms of you know, the new rising stars and talent, etc., and then onboarding these clusters onto the platform, which, you know, then it kind of like becomes a self-serving cycle, since we do have the crowdsourcing always open, and it becomes extremely aspirational. So newer artists are always invited to join. And so it kind of like creates this positive cycle of growth.
No, I think this is great. And I think the way that you guys explained the curating model that you have in terms of the multiple processes and with the themes, this is going to be really big in terms of it's always current. Mm-hmm. It's always relevant based upon that. So that way it stays fresh in everybody's mind, no matter what's going on in any part of the world. There's always going to be an impetus for a new reason to create art and a new reason to create some kind of change or movement.
No, 100%.
So I think that's big. But well, I really appreciate you guys taking the time to join us for this episode. And I look forward to seeing a lot more regarding the growth of Alpha and just seeing a lot more of your art. And I think the art world really appreciate what you grow to be. And I'm happy
to
have
been
a part of that.
Thank you so much, Baron. Thank you for having us. And also, you know, we'd like to invite the listeners to really invest in Alpha and be a part of Alpha and to join us on this fantastic journey.
Well, we definitely will encourage them to do that 100%.
Thank you. Thank you again.
Bye-bye. You too. Happy holidays.
Have a great holiday.
Happy holidays. Bye.
Good morning, and thank you for joining me for another episode of Silicon Beach Mobile Startup. Today, I'm joined by a legend in the software business and the venture capital space, Andrew Flip Filipowski, better known as Flip. He's known as a futurist and a speaker with expertise which spans topics from venture capital and entrepreneurship, Bitcoin, crypto assets, blockchain, fintech, the history of money, disruptive autonomous organizations, digital autonomous organizations. He is the founder of Platinum Technologies from 1987 to 1999, a 12-year run which resulted in an exit in a sale to Computer Associates for about $4 billion. He's acquired and integrated nearly 200 public and private companies. His current big venture is Flurry, an enterprise software company, database as a storage service with applications with tamper-proof blockchain ledger, semantic graph query engine, linearly scalable query edge servers, and co-resident data security. Flip, welcome.
It is my pleasure.
Hey, I really appreciate you taking the time to join us today. How's the weather in Palm Beach or West Palm Beach?
Same as always, about 80.
That's beautiful. That's awesome. Well, I wanted to get right into the subject matter and try to make it as conversational as possible. And kind of share some highlights of your career and the things that you want to share. What do you think was the reason you went into the software business?
It happened so many years ago that I probably have a glorified version of it only left in my head. And that was that I really actually loved the idea of messing around with computers. I certainly was emerging out of high school about the same period of time in which computers were just becoming a thing that you could aspire to touch or feel or code for in a university educational kind of environment. And I always felt that it had potential and certainly interest. But I do remember my very first job in the space. I went into a Time Incorporated data center. This was in 1968. And looked around, saw like two floors of computers and said, damn, I'm late again.
Late in terms of not being aware of what they were doing?
The whole computer thing had passed me by. I should have been born 10 years earlier or whatever was kind of the feeling that I had, that it was already all said and done.
Wow. Yeah, the industry is changing quickly all the time.
Yeah, and more opportunities today than there were then.
So if you were to look at, I guess, how the landscape looked when you first got into the business, what do you see as the real opportunities right now?
Well, I can tell you that if there is a catalyst in the universe that is driving technology and has sort of the potential of making opportunities upon opportunities occur to entrepreneurs is the climate change. All of the things related to it are monumentally dependent on technology to solve.
Okay. So how would climate change come into play as a result or relates to software and data?
Well, I would venture that a great example that everyone could relate to is Tesla. Elon Musk has come up with a business plan to save the planet, save the human race. Kind of hard to value a business that has that as an objective because it's almost an unlimited value. And I think he will create, and Tesla will create in its various components, unbelievable value. And if it doesn't, it'll die trying with the rest of the human race.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you look at brands like Tesla and Apple, what do you think that makes them stand out and makes them resonate with so many people? Is it because of, I guess, the user experience or the complexity or the ease of use of the technology?
Well, there's certainly a component of all of them, but I think that you cannot escape from recognizing the fact that both Apple had enormous influence by its founder, and as the same situation you've got here with a huge influence by Elon Musk on Tesla and everything that he does. It's someone who can articulate the vision and articulate the reasons why it's important to do. And I think all of those add up to the kind of opportunities that Tesla represents to its constituents.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I think the founder of Apple said, the reason why you hire smart people is not to tell them what to do, is to let them do it in their own way and just give them an objective. Would you agree with that?
I would. I would agree with a lot of things that were part of the Apple culture then. On the other hand, I think that it was missing a bit of benevolence, and frankly, at the time, could have been a much bigger influencing company. It had to kind of play catch up on its own strategy about the time the iPhone came out, and that, of course, was monumentally impactful on the business.
Okay. Now, when you say benevolent, I know that Fleury is a public benefit corporation. So when you say benevolent in terms of giving more to the developers or giving more to the consuming community?
No, customers. I think that Jobs as a human being running the business had a lot of sort of positive traits and influences that made Apple what Apple is today. On the other hand, Apple could probably be twice what it is today if he had done it with love in his heart.
Right. Okay. So you think the, I guess the person who is the leader kind of sets the tone of the organization, but also you feel the impact of the empathy that that person has when they deliver whatever that end product is?
I think that is a good way to say it, Baron, but I think it also you need to add to that sort of a charismatic ability to have people follow you into uncharted territory and to really articulate a strategy that everybody buys into. And I think the strategy that everybody buys into certainly happened at Apple. What didn't happen was each individual wasn't part of the team on the basis of their being the right fit. It was more of a culture that demanded certain kinds of activity, and that demand was not often done nicely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that could lead to a lot of people within the organization not appreciating the leadership as much, probably.
That's the way I see it.
Now, are you a proponent of a strong team or a strong product, which leads to the greatest chance of success?
That's a really good question. And I think I've always expressed it as it needs to be the right team for the right product. If you took the people that are working on a given project and it's the music business, that's a different team than the one that's working on a autonomous vehicle. The trick here is to assemble the right team with the right components of skills and capabilities and make them operate as a team, not just picking individuals who have some sort of skill sets that are unquestionably top of the category. But believe me, as much as I will say all of those things, I will say that, yes, it's assembling the right team for the right product. That's the only way you get to the success that I think some of us admire and value creation that the truly successful companies have done.
Now, a question I would ask you, and this is for a lot of entrepreneurs or a lot of people in corporate America. I mean, there's probably a lot of engineers and scientists sitting there with a lot of great ideas, and they're looking for the opportunity to exit. So when do you think is the best time to start a business?
Well, I think the best time is immediately. As soon as you feel that you've articulated to yourself something that you could be passionate about and pursue to no end, with determination and all of the required concentration that entrepreneurship does. And I frankly say it with a tongue in cheek that starting it immediately is important, because if you give it enough time, you'll convince yourself it's impossible.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you find that as an entrepreneur, you get more support from family and friends, or more support from, I guess, contacts that understand your industry more than, you know, as much as you, they have a common interest in your industry?
Yeah, there's probably two answers here. One is, if you are doing your first entrepreneurial activity, then friends and family are critical to getting you the runway in which to pursue your dream, just sort of on the belief that the money will ultimately come from other sources as you develop the idea into something that can be appreciated by a venture capitalist or other type of investor. If it's your second, third, or fourth effort, if you're a serial entrepreneur, the second and third and fourth, assuming your first worked out, you know, you don't rely on family and friends as much because you can probably raise the money from the folks that experienced your first effort.
Mm-hmm. Now, I noticed with Fleury, you've got the backing of some pretty prominent VCs. And I think there was a fund that maybe Steve Case was the founder of that has some involvement in Fleury. Can you speak to that a little
bit? Sure. Steve Case's fund is called Revolution. And he, along with a fellow by the name of J.D. Vance, who wrote the book Hillbilly Elegy, they created a sub-fund to the Revolution Fund, which is a very large dollar amount fund. They created this Rise of the Rest, focusing their investments on folks that were not coastal or not in the traditional places where venture capital can be found, like Silicon Valley or New York. They created a fund where they were very specially interested in getting funding to people who were in the flyover states, so to speak. And that is what appealed to that group, not only our background and experience in doing other businesses, but the fact that we were in Winston-Salem, North Carolina.
Now, is Winston-Salem considered part of the research triangle to some degree?
No, that's the Raleigh-Durham area.
Okay. So what is the, I know that Chicago in the Midwest is called Silicon Prairie. Is there a name for the area in Winston-Salem?
Probably Krispy Kreme donuts.
Okay. The flavor du jour. Oh, that's awesome. So do you think, if you're looking back, that creativity or education is the biggest driver for business success?
Between the two that you mentioned, creativity, I think, wins. Education is relatively worthless unless you pursue it yourself. I don't think formal education has ever made an entrepreneur. It is when you become very passionate about something and you take the library of books that is available or material that have been written on the topic and consume it all and consume it with a kind of passion that says you want to make that your own thing. And so creativity added on top of that is what I think would be my vote for what is more important.
No, I think you're absolutely right. Because I do reflect back at my time at Purdue and some of the different classes and subjects that we learn in school. And I think the way that they teach level of knowledge. I was in the investment business at Merrill Lynch when I met you. And my understanding of the venture capital space was absolutely zero at that time. But coming to LA, meeting a prominent VC, and then doing some study and research on information theory. And all of a sudden, my mind just, you know, awakened to all this possibility. So I agree with you. You really got to dig in and create your own native knowledge once you get some basis.
I certainly believe 100% in what you just said.
Now, if we were to look a little bit closer at Fleury, what do you think are some of the standout elements or features of Fleury?
Fleury is something that could only be done today. 45 years ago, if we would have attempted to do Fleury, we would have been doing something like a relational database, which I think by itself is now celebrating 45 or 50 years of existence, and very few things survive intact in the industry. So there's a really big need for a new approach to data platforms generally. And blockchain is a huge part of anything that is to be created as a data platform layer. I also believe very strongly in graph as a style of database that I think will reach prominence. When you add all three of those ingredients together, you get a remarkable soup of technology that can yield artificial intelligence componentry that all the things that today, the Internet of Things, autonomous vehicles are generating the kind of information, the volumes, the importance to be able to analyze that information in real time, that databases of composed and data platforms composed of these piece parts are what will shine in the not too distant future and will become the replacement technologies that will replace all of today's antiquities, the antiquity of relational databases, the antiquity of file systems, NoSQL, et cetera.
Now, how do you look at the size of blocks with the current blockchain technology? Do you think that has increased?
That only applies to things related to Bitcoin, only applies to the specific crypto assets. Blockchain can be defined as any size, any shape, any kind of component that is necessary for a business application to function. And I think there are multitude of ways that one can view the blockchain size and shape depending on who's using it for what purposes. If you have a logistic system that is being shared by 50 enterprises, none of which own it, but the 50 have to be permissioned to use it, as opposed to permissionless, which is what a crypto asset like Bitcoin usually requires, that presents an entire different strategy in terms of how you assign block size and whether it's related to big or small and required to be big or small.
So blockchain, is it,
it does
specifically
have it
geared towards being
it's
just
not new.
A new
it's,
form of cryptography?
Know, lots of things have already been predefined. It can be used very easily to give you the cryptology part that you need in this equation. But the specifics of securing and making sure some data is immutable, making sure that the data can't be changed and violated, those are all parts of the blockchain technology that gets incorporated into a data platform.
So that being said, in my mind, the financial services industry would seem like it would be the biggest beneficiary.
But the medical field is an example of another. There are so many that ultimately the answer is it's a cross-industry phenomenon. It does not necessarily address only one industry like finance. It is almost any industry you could mention, you will find that blockchain ultimately will be a prevalent technology.
So would you say it's better served
massive amounts of data that needs to be analyzed is certainly
created?
Part of it, but you also need it so that you do not have information that can be changed and attacked. You need data and information in a blockchain database that can defend itself and make sure that no altercations can filter into the equation.
Mm-hmm.
Security becomes, I think, one of the biggest beneficiaries of a blockchain-based data platform.
Now, I like that when I was reading through the website regarding Flurry, and they mentioned the statement of data being able to defend itself.
Yes,
is that something that's part of your IP that you developed?
Mostly brought to the table by blockchain.
Okay. And I like the other another statement.
Well, because you have all the data that's ever been related to
How does that work?
Piece of information in, you know, in its entirety from birth to now. You can travel back and see it the way it was 2 years ago, 3 years ago. A good example to visualize it would be something like a cap table. People struggle with putting cap tables together because they often feel that they need to know what happened on January 1st versus June 1st of a given year. So what Flurry provides is that time travel where you don't need to create a data warehouse. You don't need to create information copies, which is where most of the vulnerabilities get introduced. But with the live information, since it's there and never can be changed, you can travel back in time to any date, any block, and end up with information that is 100% verifiably correct for that period in time. In fact, you can utilize it in time travel going forward. You can use an appropriate technology like Flurry to work in that direction as opposed to just historically.
Now, I have a question regarding Flurry. Now, how does it address the thought of speed versus decentralization?
Well, because the way it,
my understanding
it,
is that
it
that
works is
slower
the following.
Movement of
speed
information.
In terms of query and getting the information to become valuable. That's a native strong suit of a Flurry data platform. Updating is not a strong suit, but it is addressed by the fact that you can unlimitedly, without limitation, shard the database. And so each data, independent data platform can provide millions of transactions per day. However, you can multiply that almost to infinity if you shard and define the data store as being able to handle multiple databases. The beautiful part of the Flurry query platform is that it's separate from the data update platform. And in the fact that it is in a position to provide information from a very big database, huge database, you've got the situation where the sharding is invisible. In other words, once you define it, when you ask a query of that information, you do not have to know that it's one shard, two shard, 50 shards, billions of shards. You just ask the question and you get the answer. So it's addressed by that method as opposed to being natively strong at updating.
So my question is, I understand with sharding, you basically, you'll take whatever this piece of information, and rather than linearly each node identifying and understanding what the information is, you assign a subset of each piece, which is the sharding, I guess, and then
that is correct. One other way to think about it and visualize
as opposed
it
to linearly,
is
correct?
To end up with a alphabet. And use that in the context of a name. If you have an employee name that starts with A, it ends up in the A shard. If you have a name that starts with a B, it's in the B shard. You can break it up and sub-break it up any number of ways that you want. And it will create all of the shards, and high-speed performance will become part and parcel of that sharding. But it's invisible. That's the important thing, because you don't need to understand how the data was put together in order to ask questions of it in a very sophisticated way.
I think that with you, and I saw that Brian Platt your team for quite some time, your understanding of the product is absolute. And typically you'll have a technical co-founder and a non-technical co-founder, but it seems as though you guys are a good fit.
We are one of those fits that I certainly appreciate very much. I've worked with Brian for 20, 30 years, and it is one of those trusting relationships that one needs in order to really create something special. And so I admire his skills, his technology capabilities. And the thing is that we overlap and can pick up for each other also. So it's worked very well over the years.
So Flip, I would like to give you an opportunity to kind of like, I guess, give us a kind of like a word of wisdom that you would give to, I guess, aspiring entrepreneurs out there, how to approach, you know, this market and the uncertainty.
Yeah, I think that we almost brushed upon this in an earlier statement that we made during this podcast. But I would like to remind, I think, folks that dreams are not what you have when you're asleep. Dreams are what keep you awake at night. And that's when you know that something special is attracting you. If you're being kept up at night with a dream of a particular solution that can be turned into an entrepreneurial effort, that's when you know you've got it right. And I think as you get sort of through a multitude of entrepreneurial efforts, at some point you recognize the fact that the human race is really a relay race, and a relay race in the sense that you pass on the baton to people who have new variations, new creative componentry that they add to your baton, and they create their own, and they pass it on to another set of generations at the end of their entrepreneurial effort. And I often tell people that's the most rewarding part of entrepreneurship, is when you get to that, passing it along. And for startup entrepreneurs, I remind them to seek these kinds of folks out who are ready to pass the baton in a relay race. That's where you're going to get the most hope, the most support, the most money, if you can tie into some entrepreneurial characters who have done it before and are interested in supporting an entrepreneurial fresh effort.
Well, I think you just created a tagline and a hashtag, pass the baton. I just have to say it's been an honor and a privilege to know you all these years. And I've kind of learned from afar and I've observed, but I having the opportunity to have these conversations is a unique opportunity. And I appreciate
that. Well, that's ditto. And I certainly appreciate every opportunity to spend time with you.
Well, Flip, I hope you have an outstanding and amazing 2020, and I appreciate you for taking the time out today.
It was my pleasure, my honor, and thank you so much. Have a beautiful 2020. May it be the best year you've ever had. To everybody listening, too. Talk to you soon.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you, Baron.
Bye.